hppodcraft.com.
It was an evening party, and something someone had said to me had started me talking about a subject that to me is full of fascination, the subject of old religions, forsaken gods. The truth, for all religions have some of it, the wisdom, the beauty of the religions of countries to which I travel, have not the same appeal for me, for one only notices in them their tyranny and intolerance and the abject servitude that they claim from thought. But when a dynasty has been dethroned in heaven and goes forgotten and outcast even among men, one's eyes, no longer dazzled by its power, find something very wistful in the faces of fallen gods suppliant to be remembered, something almost tearfully beautiful, like a long, warm summer twilight fading gently away after some day memorable in the story of earthly wars. Between what Zeus, for instance, has been once and the half-remembered tale he is today, there lies a space so great that there is no change of fortune known to man whereby we may measure the height down which he has fallen. And it is the same with many another god at whom once the ages trembled and the 20th century treats as an old wives' tale. The fortitude that such a fall demands is surely more than human.
Was that about some old guy falling or something? Like, is that a Med Alert commercial? Is that what that is?
This Christmas, the gods have fallen and they can't get up. Dunsember.
That was from the opening paragraph of The Exiles Club, a story by Lord Dunsany and a favorite of H.P. Lovecraft. And that's why we're talking about him here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Laggy.
And we're also going to be covering another Dunsany story, The Three Infernal Jokes, which are going to be our conclusion to this Dunsember.
Dunsember. And I want to say, Pfeiffer, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
This episode drops on Christmas Day, and I hope you have a nice one, or a Saturnalia, or Yuletide.
Or Hanukkah, or Kwanzaa, or some people maybe celebrating Festivus.
Yes.
In my home, we like to celebrate the very Dunsany-sounding Zagmuk holiday.
I don't know what that is.
It's a Mesopotamian holiday, predates Christmas. Zagmuk, it was believed that every winter, the Mesopotamian god Marduk would battle the monsters of chaos.
Right.
And so everybody would have a festival to help him out during the battle. That, of course, lasted 12 days. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have the 12 days of Christmas. Over here, we've got the 12 days of Zagmuk.
Wow. When did this happen, Pfeiffer? I didn't know that you were...
I just converted to it this year.
Oh, okay, great.
We're giving it a shot. As part of our celebrations, we make sure to watch lots of movies about people battling monsters.
Yeah.
We try to be as lazy as possible in order to conserve strength for for Marduk's great struggle. Well, what would happen is that the king, whoever the king was supposed to join Marduk in his fight on that last day.
Oh.
In order to beat the monsters. And so what they would do is they'd create a fake king, like a doll with a crown, and they would feed it and banquet it, and they'd do all these nice things to it, and then when midnight would come, they'd tear all its clothes off and destroy it and burn it so that it could rise to the heavens and finish the battle off.
Wow.
Alongside Marduk, yeah.
Huh.
So we haven't ironed out what we're going to do in terms of that yet, you know, today. I also want to say we're not doing a show for the 1st of January.
No, because the January has 5 Thursdays in there, so we're taking the week off at the beginning of the month instead of the end.
That's right, so we'll be back on the 8th. But in the interim, I'm going to release, it'll be short, just a few songs, but it'll be a little EP called The Monster Party in order to commemorate the wonderful monster party that we had all year.
Yeah, we had lots of fun with monsters this year.
So there won't be a show on New Year's Day, but there will be music. We have all week, of course, been running our yearly Christmas poems.
Right, yeah. Andrew Lehman has read some of Lovecraft's poems that he wrote for the holiday season. Lovecraft was a big fan of Christmas, Yuletide, and he wrote a ton of Christmas poems.
We hope you've been enjoying them, and we hope you enjoy your Christmas holiday. I guess we should get into this story, which Andrew read the opening of.
Yes, Andrew's also, he has covered this entire month of Dunsember, and it's great to have him on board. It's just an Andrew Lehman narration month, and I couldn't be happier.
Couldn't be happier to have him closing out the year with us on our last show of 2014. Now, that story that we heard at the top, the intro, Exiles Club, this is from The Last Book of Wonder, which was originally published as Tales of Wonder. It's the 10th book and 6th original short story collection by Dunsany. Previously, the stories we've been doing are from The Book of Wonder, which is a few years older.
Right.
This is from 1916, so hopefully we're going to ease up a little on the thieving stories.
Right. Yeah, there's
from that volume.
No thieving in either of these two stories.
Woohoo!
So the story starts off at a party, and the narrator is talking about gods that no one believes in anymore. And I have to say that first paragraph was really interesting to me. I thought it was good. I was kind of set up for like, okay, this sounds like it's going to be a cool story if it kind of touches on these subjects.
And that notion that gods don't go away, that they just kind of come down and walk among men or they get exiled somehow, that pops up in fiction a lot.
Sure does. You bet.
It immediately made me think of American Gods by...
Right, me too. Yeah, I thought of that. And lots of... there's the Almighty Johnstons or Almighty Johnsons, that Australian show where they're all the Norse gods, but they're in human bodies. And it just seems like it's a kind of a reoccurring theme that's been popular in the last... I don't know, 20 years or so.
Yeah, and that's actually the God Squad, the thing I wrote for Zachtoons, that Australian
right.
company, is about fallen gods who go to King's Cross in Sydney, and some of them are criminals and some of them are cops. It's kind of a procedural thing. It's actually nominated for Best Short Film in the Australian Academy Awards.
I know.
This month in January, so it's a popular notion.
Fingers crossed, Pfeiffer.
So this conversation is happening about what happens with gods when their time has come, when they're no longer worshipped.
When does a religion become a mythology? You know, something that I often... consider. And is it ever really a mythology? I mean, doesn't somebody somewhere still worship Zeus?
I hope so.
And Jupiter and Ra and all the other gods? You know, it seems to be really difficult to get an idea completely out of a civilization.
Right. And that's what they're talking about at this dinner party.
Our narrator, who we don't get a name from, he's overheard by this guy who turns out to be the ex-king of Aritavaria?
Yeah. It's made up. It's Dunsany stuff.
He's the ex-king of this place. He's not the king anymore, and he's in exile. So the king's, or the ex-king's servant, invites the narrator to come to his club and join him for a meal.
Right.
He got a little nervous because he thinks, oh man, did I hit a nerve with this guy? Because I was talking about the whole fallen from power thing, and that maybe... my invitation had something to do with it because he could relate to that because he was a king and now he's no longer a king.
Where were you thinking the story was going at this point?
I thought that it was going to turn out that that guy was maybe not a king, but a god.
Yeah, I kind of thought that too.
That's where I thought it was going.
But I didn't know where this was going to go also because in my... I've never read this before, and as people kind of pitched it to me, they said, oh, this is Dunsany's horror story.
Really?
Be prepared for that. So I was like, wow, okay.
I don't see that. And there's nothing horrible... about it.
Well, there are some things that are horrible about it, but maybe not in the way that... Yeah, I don't know. But I was thinking this is an odd setup for a horror story, but okay.
Yeah.
The guy, the narrator, decides to go to this dinner that he's been invited to by the exiled king. And it's at this kind of crazy club.
Yeah. And that was the thing in Victorian England. These clubs still exist where there's these private... You have to be a member to go in and drink and hang out at these places.
Right.
In fact, I went to one, a friend of my wife, Rachel... She's a member of one of these clubs. So I went to one of them. It felt more like a coffee house than a pub.
Sure.
Like, just the way the furniture was, the way that like was old and, you know, in London. And it wasn't fancy or anything like that. But these things still exist, these clubs where people go and they pay membership. And I don't know what the criteria is for becoming a member. I guess it's different for each club.
I think it's different for each club. You remember in Utah, you have to join a club if you want to drink at those bars there.
That's right. Yeah. When we were at Park City. I forgot that. Yeah.
Well, this club is in this insane house in some strange, you know, kind of squalid corner of London.
The place itself is amazing. It says, lifting right up above those grotesque houses and built in that Greek style that we call Georgian, there was something Olympian about it.
Yeah, it's an amazingly huge place. And of course, to the exiled king, he wouldn't know that he's in an unfashionable street.
Right.
With this building, it says all his youth, wherever he had gone, had become fashionable the moment he went there, which I thought was a cool line, you know. Anywhere he goes is instantly cool.
Right.
It reminded me of Los Angeles a little bit, actually, where you could have just a crappy hot dog stand downtown, but if George Clooney ate there, oh, you got to go to this place. It immediately makes it cool, no matter how... part of town it's in. In fact, the more rundown it is, the cooler it is if somebody with some celebrity cachet went there, you know. Or you'll go to the dry cleaner and the headshots are on the wall. It's always everybody's got headshots on the wall here. What does that mean, you know? You go to the dry cleaner and it's like a 20-year-old picture of Stephen Baldwin and it says, you know, thanks, Jay, for getting those skin marks out. It's like an XXLO. Why does that make me want to come here, you know?
Skin marks.
Baldwin writes some really personal stuff.
Yeah, I guess so. He does. Sure sounds like it. So the king welcomes him in, and it's super fancy inside as well. There's this awesome staircase that seems to be made out of this rare marble, and it's, you know, super fancy. It's got gold on the banisters and all that stuff. But strangely, he takes the narrator down to the basement into this banquet hall that's set up, and it's seating for like 20 people. Funny thing is, all the chairs are thrones except for one. That chair is the narrator's chair. And so he asks, why am I
in the folding chair?
Yeah, why do I get the crappy chair? And he goes, oh, well, every member of this club was by rights a king. Oh, so that's the criteria for becoming a member of this club, is you had at one time, as long as you were a king by heredity or lawful descent from a king.
Yeah.
So that means if, you know, your dad was a king and you were the firstborn.
So you can either be somebody who was deposed from the throne or somebody who just never got to, because of whatever happened.
Right.
You're of the bloodline, but you couldn't sit on the throne.
Exactly. This guy seems to be from, you know, all these guys seem to be from like lost kingdoms.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't, you know, it's nothing anybody's ever heard of, but they can trace it back like many generations and stuff. So a lot of these are kind of mythic.
It says it's they're mythic places where the heroes of history fought with the gods of myth.
Right.
Much like Marduk.
Yeah.
This is just the perfect story to read.
The reason for the season.
It's the reason for the season. Marduk's the reason for the season.
So this place, this club, has lots of fancy heirlooms from these lost kingdoms. This perfect porcelain item that was exactly the right shade of purple. There is a statue of a dragon and a princess, and the dragon is stealing this diamond from the princess.
And there's a real diamond in its claws.
Yeah.
Which is... of the first water.
Of the first water.
Finally saw it in action.
There's a pair of amethyst cups from a turban king of Fu. Mm-hmm. The king there points out his artifact, and it is a hood ornament from a really fancy car.
The only thing he managed to get away with. You know, a lot of these guys, it was because they had to either scram right away, so they just got a box of whatever they had around, you know, and I think he just wound up with this hood ornament.
So the king shows off this stuff, but nothing really from his kingdom. He thinks about how he wish he had wrote stuff down, our narrator, because he was like, yeah, wow, these things are really cool and people just don't get to see them, because he didn't really think much about it because he assumed he was going to be invited back.
Right. It says, had I known this was the last time I should wish to enter that club, I would have written all this down.
We got a bit of foreshadowing that, okay, I guess he's not coming back to this club for some reason. So all these kings sit down, he joins them, but during the meal, the wine starts to flow pretty heavy and the exiles begin to talk. And they tell strange tales of their old kingdoms, mostly kind of poor me stories about the former kings and, you know, these epic tragedies of how they lost their kingdoms and things like that. Now, the people that are the descendants of kings and never ruled, they've got the crazy stories, you know, like people riding on dragons and, you know, French kissing minotaurs and stuff like that. You know, like those are the ones where it's just totally out there.
And, you know, the fact that they're dining in the basement, I obviously is significant. I have to admit, it didn't occur to me.
No.
When I read it the first time, that was... It's such an odd scene that the fact that they were downstairs in this giant club, I don't know, it didn't stand out to me. Obviously, it's very significant.
Right. So they talk and they whine for a bit, but for some reason, the narrator says the word upstairs and the mood changes. Mm-hmm. Why he says upstairs is when he saw those stairs, he thought, you know, he just asked if he could check out upstairs to see if there's any more cool artifacts, because he didn't know if that... what he saw was all of them, or if there was more, or whatever. But when he
right.
when he brings this up, the room just falls quiet.
Upstairs, he gasped. We cannot go upstairs. I perceived that what I had said was an ill-chosen thing. I tried to excuse myself, but knew not how. Of course, I muttered, members may not take guests upstairs. Members, he said to me. We are not the members. There was such reproof in his voice that I said no more. I looked at him questioningly. Perhaps my lips moved. I may have said, what are you? A great surprise had come on me at their attitude. We are the waiters, he said. That I could not have known. Here at last was honest ignorance that I had no need to be ashamed of. The very opulence of their table denied it. Well, then who are the members? I asked. Such a hush fell at that question, such a hush of genuine awe, that all of a sudden a wild thought entered my head, a thought strange and fantastic and terrible. I gripped my host by the wrist and hushed my voice. Are they too exiles? I asked. Twice as he looked in my face, he gravely nodded his head. I left that club very swiftly indeed, never to see it again, scarcely pausing to say farewell to those menial kings. And as I left the door, a great window opened far up at the top of the house, and a flash of lightning streamed from it and killed a dog.
So I guess if you're a canine reading this, it definitely is a horror story.
I guess so, like, yeah.
What's up with the drive-by on the dog, man? That doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. It's a cleansing bolt of lightning, though.
That's true.
That's where Lovecraft got it. That last bit contradicts earlier in the story, because The line earlier in the story says, "My host explained to me when we all sat down that everyone who belonged to that club was by rights a king."
Right, but they're kings of...
Kings of...
They're princes of the universe.
Right. I would call those gods, not kings.
Yes, right.
So I think that is a bit of a cheat.
Well, I think that that's when he says in that last paragraph that we heard, which is the end of the story, I guess. That's
yeah, it's the end.
That he scarcely paused to say farewell to those menial kings. He realizes, oh, there's greater kings up there.
Right.
It's, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, one, whoever told you this was supposed to be a horror story, it's... It's ridiculous. I don't understand.
A lot of people told me that. Yeah. Well, I see that he runs away in fear at the end of it. So it's about something horrific that happens to somebody.
Yeah.
So by that definition, it is. Although by my definition, which is that I feel a measure of creepiness or terror or something that approaches fear.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Not even close. No, there were a bunch of his other stories I thought were way creepier and scarier than this.
Yeah.
This is a joke to me. I laughed at the end of it.
Of course. I was like, did Thor fart up there? Like, what happened, you know? Actually, I thought it would have been great if they were at the table and he said, go upstairs. We can't go upstairs. We're the waiters. And then they heard some noise and then Zeus came down in a towel with just his gut hanging over him. He was like, bottle of wine, just all loaded. Like, hey, is there a corkscrew somewhere? I can't find it anywhere. And all the waiters scramble. All the kings are running around trying to find a corkscrew. And it's just our narrator looking at him. And then Zeus looks at him and drops the towel. The end.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a little closer to the horror genre, I think.
Horror? Listen, I was reading that one. Like you said at the beginning of this stuff, this reminded me of American Gods.
American
and stuff.
Gods. But yeah.
Do you remember that show that Jeremy Piven was on that was only on for like a season called Cupid?
I do.
I loved that show.
Was he a deity? He was actually Cupid.
You didn't know. Well, everybody treated him like he was crazy, but then he would do strange things. Like they would always kind of put that twist in,
right?
Because his whole thing was because he got too arrogant. Zeus made him mortal until he could match up 100 people.
Ah, that was a good show.
Yeah, I remember. I loved it, and it was funny, and Jeremy Piven was good in it because, you know, he was playing a jerk. But it, like, that was the thing. He was a real jerk, but he had to try and fix people up together. And
right.
Then when he did that, and so I don't remember if the female lead in the show was his psychiatrist or was a reporter or something. But something would happen at the end of every episode or during an episode that made her wonder.
That's great.
Of course, it's an old show. So
yeah,
probably in rewatching, it's very 90s and not very good. But I remember thinking it was pretty great.
I do too. But you never know if something's going to hold up or not. That was called his horror story. Somebody told me the next one is a horror comedy. I will say it's kind of funny. It's called The Three Infernal Jokes.
This is the story that the desolate man told to me on the lonely highland road one autumn evening, with winter coming on and the stags roaring. The saddening twilight, the mountain already black, the dreadful melancholy of the stags' voices, his friendless, mournful face, all seemed to be of some most sorrowful play staged in that valley by an outcast god. A lonely play of which the hills were part, and he the only actor. For long we watched each other drawing out of the solitudes of those forsaken spaces. Then, when we met, he spoke. I will tell you a thing that will make you die of laughter. I will keep it to myself no longer, but first I must tell you how I came by it.
Okay, so the narrator runs into a guy who's got a story to tell. Well, he's got a joke
right.
to tell. Unfortunately, it's not Don Rickles.
Ah, would that it were.
This story makes a lot more sense if it was Don Rickles. But it's not. It's just some guy. And he has this joke that will kill you.
You hear it, right?
If you hear this joke. Now, this immediately made me think of the Monty Python sketch, The World's Funniest Joke, which was a joke that was so funny that whoever heard it or read it died from laughter.
It's a classic sketch. We got to link out to that.
Yeah, you got
to
watch it. It's really funny. Some guy comes up with it, writes it down. Then somebody finds it, lifts it, reads it. They die. And people keep doing it until the British government...
It gets weaponized. Yeah, it's like a World War II.
right. <thing. laughs>
Because that's one of my favorite things in it is they have to translate it one word at a time into German. Because... The one guy accidentally reads two words of it. He winds up in the hospital. That was like my favorite part
yes.
of it. Just two words of the Joker and like will damage you.
But anyway, back to this, which isn't unfortunately as good as the Monty Python sketch.
No, but I wonder if it's possible that they had read this or heard of it.
It's possible. So this haggard guy starts telling our narrator how he came by this lethal joke.
Right. It's another club story. He was at the club.
But this isn't a club for gods or exiled kings. It's a club for insurance men. Fire insurance, life insurance, that kind of thing. That's what they did. But this guy was a pillar of virtue. He didn't drink. He didn't smoke. He didn't do women. You know, he wasn't into women at all, which, is that a virtue?
Well, this whole thing, yeah, so they're sitting around. They're all boasting about how virtuous they are. That's how this starts. So one of them says, hey, I don't like the taste of wine, and I don't drink at all. And then our guy leans forward and he says, hey, one woman to me is as ugly as another. So I don't go out whoring, I guess is what he
says. I guess so.
But these aren't virtues. To me, a virtue is to deny yourself something. I mean, isn't a virtue like not having poor behavior, holding yourself to very high standards,
yeah.
So not indulging in things that you might want to. But if you don't like the taste of wine, you don't like the taste of it. That's not a virtue.
No, that's not a virtue.
Why would you drink it if you don't like it? And it's the same if this guy doesn't like women.
Yeah.
He's just gay. Yes. Or asexual.
Could be.
That's not a virtue. I mean,
no,
it's just how
the way
he
is.
I don't know.
Yeah, so good.
But when he flies out with that, though, at the club, he says, one woman is as ugly as any other woman to me. They're all like, well, that dude's as virtuous as it comes. Night's over. And they all leave him.
So he's by himself, except for this other dude who's there. He's a stranger. And he comes up and he says, hey, look, man, me and my company are interested in buying your virtue.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
That's a pretty rare virtue.
What do you want for it?
Well, I mean, I think the guy's saying it'd probably go pretty cheap if you don't care about it that much. Your virtue. Because he says that's a surpassing virtue. He goes, I don't really have any use for it.
Yeah.
And he goes, all right, well, maybe I can buy it from you. The people I work with, they might, my firm, they give pretty good price for it, I think.
So he goes over to the phone, gets on the horn, and it's a bunch of, yeah, no, okay, yeah, all right. How about, I can give you three jokes, he says. Yeah, I can give you three jokes, which shall make people who hear them simply die of laughter.
Right. That's the offer. He didn't just get on the phone. He took the phone that was inside, cut the wire of it, brought it to a window, fastened the wires to a lightning conductor that went into the ground, deep into the ground. And then he made the call. So he called hell.
Yeah.
Essentially, which I thought was kind of a fun little device.
Right. Sure.
He called to hell to get this offer of these three lethal jokes, and that's what he's going to offer up for the
When I read that, did he misunderstand and think that when he says die of laughter that he didn't literally mean die of laughter?
I think that our guy is just like, this dude's a weirdo and I'm barely paying attention.
Right.
And sure, I doubt that he really thinks he can kill anybody with these jokes.
Right.
I think he's got to think it's figurative.
The stranger gives him three slips of paper, each with a joke. He reads them and he goes, these aren't funny. Right. What's wrong with you? And he goes, no, you're immune to them.
Yeah.
They're not going to work on you because that would be silly. That wouldn't really be to your benefit.
Now, our guy, he has a really, I feel bad for him because his job really sucks. There was this American firm that had bought, for the price of waste paper, 100,000 copies of the Dictionary of Electricity. And this book is not very well done. It was not only was the information in it already outdated when it was written, but the author also didn't really understand electricity. So the thing is just a crap book. But this American firm is like, let's turn a dime on it. They bought all of the junk and they've given it to him to be a basically door-to-door salesman of this Dictionary of Electricity, which he either sells to people who don't understand it as a really good book or to people who do know that it's crap to say, well, yeah, but isn't it fun how it's quaint and everything's wrong? And it's like, you know, then he's trying to get him with the hipster.
Right.
Ironic
exactly,
purchase
yeah.
argument there. So that's really what he's occupied with, very mundane things. And when he gets the jokes, he doesn't think much more of it. He just sticks them in his jacket pocket.
Later down the road, one night he's about to go have dinner over at his club. And he puts on his jacket and he reaches in his pockets and he goes, oh, yeah, these jokes. Huh. Maybe these will go over. Maybe I'll try them tonight and see if the boys are down to the club think, you know, if they're any good. So he goes down to the club. You know, things are kind of going on. He's kind of a little bit mousy. He's in the back. He goes, I'm going to try and tell one of these jokes. So he does. He tells one of the joke. It's lame, but they laugh. And then they keep laughing and they laugh harder and harder. And then he thinks that they're making fun of him. Like they're laughing at like how lame his joke is.
He's mad. He's like, there was not much use in having a friend. He thought if one silly joke could not be overlooked, he thinks they're making fun of him. He goes, he had fed them too. He's extra indignant about it. I gave them food.
He's just so angry. He just, up and leaves as they're laughing.
But when they characterize the laughter, I mean, like he can see veins pulsating in the heads of these people as they're laughing. I mean, they are really roaring and choking.
He leaves before anything serious happens because when he gets home, the next day, he reads the headlines. It says 22 dead at the club.
It killed him. Everybody that heard that joke died.
All of them.
Not even the waiters. Here's what makes me mad. How could he possibly be connected to, I mean, obviously he's connected, but how could he be, how could they convict him of doing it?
I don't know.
It just seems like so implausible, but he still goes on the run.
And he gets caught and he goes to trial.
I just wish that he hadn't run away.
Yeah, it just doesn't make it, well, I mean, it's a ridiculous story anyway. Yeah, so, yeah. And it's funny, it's silly.
They catch him, they put him in cuffs, they bring him to jail, and then he's got to go on trial.
Right, so he's in the box giving his testimony, and he realizes, oh, he's got the slips of paper.
He has an awesome lawyer at trial, actually, who comes near getting him off for this crime.
Right.
I mean, the guy tells this, gives this really impassioned speech. Jury's totally on his side, but he's compelled. He has to go sit in the jury box and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when things go south. He almost got out of there, but when he tells him, well, it was, he actually tells him the truth, I think.
Yeah.
He told this joke, and they all laughed to death, and everybody's like, oh, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This guy's full of it.
And they're like, what's the joke? And he goes, all right, well, and he looks at this piece of paper that had the joke on it, and it's blank now. So there's nothing on there. But he remembers the joke. You know, he can tell it from memory, and he does. And it doesn't even really make any sense. It's an Irishman once, on being asked by his master to buy a morning paper, said in his unusual witty way, Ara Bagara, and I will be after wishing you the top of the morning. I don't get it. That's the joke.
I think the joke is that he'll be asking for a piece of the morning paper, like the top of the morning paper, but that also is a catchphrase, top of the morning, so.
Oh, right, yeah, okay, that's the joke.
It's a terrible joke. It's a terrible joke.
Right, and nobody laughs.
Right.
Everybody just sits there and is like.
It's just crickets.
Yeah, nothing. And he goes, well, I do have another joke.
Yeah, because obviously this isn't going to help his defense.
Yeah. And then he reads that joke. Everybody dies in the courtroom.
Yeah, everybody starts laughing, and everybody in the courtroom dies, and he walks out past them without even... He can't stand to look at them as he walks out of the room watching them laugh themselves to death.
And that's it. I mean, so he's on the lam for years. He's wandering around, starving, trying to make it...
He's got this one joke left.
And he's decided he's going to tell it to our narrator.
Yeah, well, the narrator gets the impression, yeah, it might be about to happen.
He paused, his story told... And then his lip quivered as though he would say more, and I believe he intended then and there to yield up his deadly joke on that Highland road, and to go forth then with his three blank slips of paper, perhaps to a felon's cell, with one more murder added to his crimes, but harmless at last to man. I therefore hurried on, and only heard him mumbling sadly behind me, standing bowed and broken, all alone in the twilight, perhaps telling over and over even then, the last infernal joke.
So that's the end of the story.
I liked it. I liked that one.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, funny-ish.
It was like a little Twilight Zone episode. I mean, I can even see it. You know, all the people laughing. And
not quite as ironic, really.
No. Other than he's a humorless kind of boring person who winds up having, you know. But sure, if it was the Twilight Zone, actually, I'm sure it would have been a bumbling stand-up comic who couldn't get his career afloat. That would have been the much more dramatic way to do it. Now, you know, Dunsany actually did discover Lovecraft after Lovecraft's death.
Right.
Jason Thompson, who had helped us with some source material earlier in this month, sent an email about it. And it's a quote from I Am Providence, from Joshi's I Am Providence, talking about it.
When Lovecraft's work was posthumously published in book form, Dunsany came upon it and confessed that he had an odd interest in Lovecraft's work, because in the few tales of his I have read, I found that he was writing in my style, entirely originally and without in any way borrowing from me, and yet with my style and largely my material. Lovecraft would have been grateful for the acknowledgement.
I think so. Especially the fact that he says, hey, he cribbed my style, but look, he did something entirely original with it.
Yeah.
That's about as nice a compliment as you could get. It's too bad that this was after Lovecraft was dead. I do like the original direction that Lovecraft took it. A little bit more than this actual source material. I have to admit, I thought that in doing this month of stories that I would become a convert, you know, that I would find that little beautiful, unique gem that is Dunsany and be interested in reading more of his work, and I'm really not. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I couldn't get into it.
Neither am I, but people have recommended to us other stories that we haven't covered and I haven't read yet. And of course, there's some longer stories that we haven't done on the show either. These are all really short stories that we've read. So maybe some of his longer stuff is more engaging, but I am a busy man.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of people have recommended The King of Elfland's Daughter, which is a novel that he wrote in the 20s. It's a fantasy novel. That is supposedly one of the greatest, most acclaimed, influential books.
For me, Dunsany didn't. I appreciate it, and I understand why Lovecraft liked it as much as he did.
Absolutely.
It's not for me.
I think you have to see it through the time period as well, although there are lots of mythological stories that feature fantasy elements, obviously. This is a guy who's creating new worlds, who's creating place names, who's creating civilizations. I mean, who was doing things that were going to wind up influencing Tolkien and a lot of modern fantasy authors that we have the benefit of having read all that stuff. So these things don't seem quite as original to us now. But probably quite mind-blowing for the readers of the time. And if they had that bent, instructive that you could create these other worlds and then build stories within them and not rely on things that were traditionally accepted within Christian mythology or within Greek mythology or any of these things that people would draw on previously. Mm-hmm. So I think in that, I can definitely see its importance. I don't think this will be the last time we read Dunsany. We'll probably come back around to it at some point. Like, I'd read more Walter de la Mare in a second.
Oh, my God.
More Rudyard Kipling. We come across these authors, and I know I'm going to be picking up their stories for quite some time. In this case, it'll probably be more on the job side.
Yeah. It's not that I hate it. I enjoyed the reading of these stories, but it wasn't something that sang to my soul.
Yeah, there you go. Didn't sing to my soul.
Pfeiffer, thank you for another great year.
Oh, yeah.
2014 was great.
It was a lot of really, really good fun, and we'll keep it up next year. We're going to have some discussions over the break and then decide some of the directions we're going to take. We're still on stories from supernatural horror and literature. But we're also talking about changing some things within the show, evolving a little bit. So we'll be revealing more of that as we go in 2015.
And we have promised Beowulf, and Beowulf will be delivered.
It will indeed. So thanks again to Andrew Lehman for doing our readings today. Make sure you keep your eyes open on chadpfeiffer.bandcamp.com for the Monster Party EP coming out just in a very short amount of time. I'll blast it over social media and on this site. Everybody enjoy your Christmas today. Enjoy your New Year's Eve.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Happy Zagmuk.
And good luck, Marduk, as you defeat the monsters of chaos.
Yeah, Marduk, you'll do it. I have faith in you.
All right. See you next year on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.